Thanks very much for that, Ratnagosha. I feel very warmly welcomed. And it's very good to be back in the Cambridge Centre. It's been a while since I've done anything here. And very good to see all of you. So yes, I was ordained in 1974. Actually, not with five other men, but with two other men and three women. And a very long time ago, it seems. So, over these 4 weeks, I'm going to be exploring different aspects of going for refuge to the Three Jewels. And this week is going to, in a way, be quite simple. I'm going to be focusing on going for refuge. I'm not sure that I'm going to really add very much to what Arya Jaya said last week. But I'll do it with my own voice, and presumably that will come across from a somewhat different angle. So we'll see. So where should we start? I think we need to start in Australia. So last year, I spent 3 months doing a Dharma tour of New Zealand and Australia. And it's a very rich, very full, very happy time. And I had the opportunity to meet up with quite a lot of old friends. And one day, I met up with an order member called Viraja, who's a friend of mine. And we wanted to go out. We were in Sydney. So he arranged to take me on the ferry across to Manly from Central Quay. So basically, it's one of the ferry boats which goes across the harbour, but you get very good views of the whole harbour, the bridge, you go by the kind of iconic opera house and so on. So we pootled across on the ferry, and I think we had an ice cream, and then we pootled back again. But somehow, just being on a boat, Viraja ended up talking to me about the Pacific and telling me about something that he'd been reading about navigation and the Pacific. So you probably didn't come for a talk on Pacific navigation, but you never know what you're going to get, do you, when you turn up at the Buddhist Centre? So, in exactly 1769, Captain Cook sailed across the Pacific. Having gone around Cape Horn, he went up to Tahiti, and then he went all the way down to New Zealand, and then carried on Australia, Dutch East Indies, and home. It took him 3 years. And in Tahiti, he picked up a local navigator, a wayfinder. And he was encouraged to do that by Joseph Banks, one of the naturalists who was in his team on the boat, because this navigator, this wayfinder, seemed to have exceptional abilities. But Captain Cook didn't really feel that he needed any sort of natives with exceptional abilities, because after all he was British, and the British Navy prided itself on its advanced navigational skills. So with that sort of typical arrogance that would characterise the British colonial empire, he just carried on. But he did notice that as their journey proceeded over thousands of miles across the Pacific, this local man could always point to the direction where they'd started from, where Tahiti was. Without using any compass or instruments, he could always point out that direction. But despite that, Captain Cook still didn't really realise that they had someone on board whose navigational skills equaled, or in a way exceeded in some ways, the skills of him and his crew. In fact, this sort of ignorance about the capacity of Polynesian peoples to navigate across the Pacific carried on right into the 20th century, right up almost to the 1970s. People knew that right across a vast swathe of the Pacific Ocean, almost a fifth of the area of the world, there were people scattered across 10,000 islands, maybe more, who spoke the same language and could communicate with one another. But it was kind of assumed that they just took to their boats with a very rudimentary idea of direction, and it was mainly chance where they ended up, because they didn't have compasses, they didn't have sextants, they didn't have GPS, they didn't have any of the ways that by which you would know where you were. So how did they do it? Well, each boat which was going any distance always had one of these navigators, local navigators, these wayfinders, who didn't use instruments, but they navigated through a whole combination of an extraordinary ongoing awareness, a very, very highly tuned sensitivity to the conditions that they were under, and a long mental training over many, many years. Firstly, they were trained to become intimately acquainted with the sea. A lot of these wayfinders, they were chosen at the age of one. And from that age, they would be put in tidal rock pools. So they just felt the movement of the currents, the movement of the sea. And as they got older, sometimes they'd be towed behind the boat in something to keep them, you know, above the surface, obviously. Where again, they would just feel the movement of the waves and this began to sense the currents. And they got incredibly intimately acquainted with those movements. A really skilled wayfinder could discern up to five different currents, up to five different sort of pulses, kind of running below the surface of the ocean. It's like in the immediate vicinity, there's just quite chaotic movement, but there are certain kind of sort of swells and currents which go right across the ocean. There are other more local ones. Each group of islands would have its own kind of signature, which someone who was really, really attuned to the waves and the water could recognise really clearly. And they also learnt about and studied the sky and the stars. In fact, usually they were taught to recognise about 200 different stars. And not only could they recognise them, but they knew when and where they would appear over the horizon, depending on where they were. Yeah. So they had this incredible sensitivity to the water, to the sky, to the stars, to the sun, the moon. Very, very detailed. And they watched and learned from the life around them. Like if there were seabirds, they would know certain birds that were on longer journeys, certain birds which would not far, fly far away from an island. They would watch all of that. Yeah. So everything, all their experience was adding to this picture. They were just very aware of all the conditions, the winds, everything. Yeah. Even the taste of the water. And all that fed into building up a picture of what was going on and where they were. They combined all this information intuitively so that they knew where they'd come from, they knew where they were. And they did that without any instruments, which was a considerable feat, because to really be able to go to where they wanted to go, it meant that they had to keep in mind their whole course so far. They had to use what's called dead reckoning. So they'd keep in mind all the journey up to here, and then there would be this moment which added more information, which gave more sense of, yes, must be here. And they'd make journeys to some of these islands which were like a needle in a haystack. Some of them, they'd get places like Easter Island, which is like, 20 miles across or something. It's less than 1 degree, out of the 360 if you're heading for it. And they would find places like that. So it required an amazing level of ongoing awareness. Yeah, they couldn't just take a few readings, consult a map. And that also meant that they couldn't just take long breaks and pick up again. They had to be steadily, constantly aware, using everything. Because at times there'd be storms, at times there'd be sea fog, sea mists. So the wayfinder would have a place, an honoured place, in the stern of the boat. And very often they would stay awake 22 hours a day doing their job. And they would be left pretty much completely undisturbed in a kind of meditation, just on and on. And people didn't disturb them because everyone's lives depended on them. Because if you missed your island, if you missed your target, you could drift a very, very long way before you had a chance to land anywhere. You could be adrift on the largest ocean on earth. And you might well die of thirst, starvation. So these wayfinders were highly valued, highly esteemed. They were perhaps the most honoured members of their societies. Yeah, there are these people living, many of them on small islands in a vast ocean. So these are the people to whom they entrust their lives, their safety on voyages, to explore, to trade, to communicate, to move safely between islands. All that's crucial. And these people had devoted their lives to acquiring this tremendous kind of mental training and then putting it at the service of their society. So I could carry on telling you about these people, but as maybe you didn't come for a talk on Polynesian navigation. So maybe I should start saying something about aspects of going for refuge to the Buddha, Dharma and Sangha. But I imagine something in you is already making connections. Bersantra hasn't completely lost the plot, probably. So, certainly for me at least, on a kind of mythic, archetypal kind of level, we're already very much in going for refuge territory. After all, carrying on with analogies, the Buddha used the analogy of the Buddhist life as being like living in danger on one bank of a river. And constructing a raft, the Dharma, of all kinds of methods and understandings to take us to the other shore. The other shore where there's security and safety. And then when we get there, we can leave the raft behind. We don't need to keep using those methods and so on. And this image of the Buddha kind of resonates a lot in various ways these days. We have plenty of refugees on boats fleeing war zones. We have plenty of families entrusting themselves to often pretty unseaworthy boats, trying to cross the Mediterranean, or boat people in other parts of the world, trying to find safety for themselves and often for their families. To arrive somewhere where they hope and imagine they can be free from danger, where they can live a new kind of life, one where they have the opportunity to fulfill their potential as human beings. And the Buddha, were he around today, would recognize, I'm sure, that parallel with his image of the raft going to the further shore of safety. He'd see it, sort of, in a way, happening literally. And he'd feel infinite compassion for those people. But, or and, he would also feel infinite compassion for us, sitting here in the UK, supposedly safe and free. After all, we're a favoured destination for people who are wanting to escape from war zones and difficulty. Because, although where we are is where so many people aspire to be, and it has to say, we have to say it's better than somewhere where you're attacked or tortured or made homeless, the Buddha would feel infinite compassion for all of us because he would see that we aren't safe either. As we pass our time watching a movie here, wandering the shopping malls of destiny, lost in the labyrinth of the internet, wherever we finally end up, that website at the end of the internet. Somebody I was speaking to recently said that he'd sort of found himself sort of late at night, sort of clicking from one thing to the next in a bit of a sort of dream. And he'd ended up, I think he said, the way he put it, although this may not be politically correct, was watching a video of fat ladies throwing themselves into swimming pools. And underneath in the comments box, somebody had written, "How on earth did I end up here?" So anyway, as we spend our, you know, precious lives doing whatever it is that we do, we don't recognise that, yes, we're not being bombed, but we aren't safe. Because sooner or later, we are going to be attacked by sickness. We're going to be tortured by old age. And we are going to be made homeless. We're going to be displaced from all we own. We're going to be separated from our loved ones and even our physical body by death. So, yeah, we have a temporary relative security. And as we know, even if we happen to be free from these things right now, we're still not completely happy. We suffer from stress, we suffer from various cravings, and even if we're very, you know, in good shape, we still suffer from not getting what we want, losing, being separated from what we like, being lumbered with what we don't like. We aren't deeply relaxed and at ease in our lives. And still, if we look a bit deeper, we find a sense of a kind of existential sense that everything isn't quite as it should be. We feel somehow a bit cut off from life. There's a sense of separate me in here, cut off from everything else out there. So even if everything seems okay, even if there's a happy tune playing, something in us knows that there's more to life than this. Something in us longs for freedom. Something in us longs to truly understand life deeply, to know it as it really is. Something in us longs to feel deeply connected with everything and everyone, not to be a separate, isolated unit. Something in us longs to have a really open heart. Something in us longs to love and to be loved. Something in us longs to be at peace, to just relax completely, to fully express our energy, to be really creative, and so on. And at times maybe we feel, well, yes, you know, that longing is there, but it could never be fulfilled. All those longings could never be fulfilled. But then we come into contact with Buddhism and we see examples of men and women who are completely free, who do understand how things are, who don't feel separate from life, who are deeply loving and compassionate, who are spontaneous and creative and full of life, but also whose minds are at peace, whatever happens, old age, sickness, death, whatever happens. A week ago, we celebrated Parinirvana Day. And you just see the Buddha at the time of his death, you know, he's losing everything, so to speak, separated from everything, completely at ease. What's on his mind? Just making sure that nobody in the entire assembly of people who are with him has any questions left. And he's so sort of sensitive to them that even after he's asked and asked and nobody's come up with any questions, he says, well, you know, if you're shy to ask, well, you know, just tell one of your friends what your question is and get them to ask on your behalf. And still nobody has any questions. So that's what he's concerned with at the moment of death. Just that. So, yeah, we read about the Buddha, we read about other men and women down through the centuries who've fully satisfied all those longings. And something in us responds, something in us resonates. Longings that we'd suppressed, hopes that we've given up on, come back to the surface. Yeah. Yes, all these things are possible. Human beings like us actually did it. Yeah. They lived in that state of freedom and so on. They crossed from samsara to nirvana. Not that samsara is a place and nirvana is a place or any, it's not really about that. I've sometimes been on retreat with people where they say, oh, you know, come to the end of the retreat, back to samsara. Samsara isn't out there at all. Yeah. The journey is an inward journey. It's not about places, but it's about ways of being. It's about ways in which we use our mind. Using our mind with or without referring back to some sense of a separate, isolated me. Opening our heart and mind to all that lives. So, seeing people who have made that journey over 2,500 years, I mean, it's been done again and again and again and again and again by so many men and women, hopefully we're inspired to make the journey, to set sail for freedom, to set sail for wisdom, to set sail for love, to set sail for peace. We set our heart on those qualities and we start to steer in their direction, using the Dharma to guide us. All those teachings and practical skills and methods which enable us to make the journey safely. And we don't go alone. You need a lot of experience before it will work to try and cross the ocean of suffering on your own. Lone sailors are very vulnerable. So we join with a community of people for help, support, and companionship on our journey. It helps a lot. It helps to keep our spirits up when the journey is difficult at times. Yeah. There can be a lot of laughter along the way. And some of our companions have much more experience than us and can help ensure that we stay on course. Some have had some glimpses, at least, some experience of the land that we're headed towards. and they can be reliable guides. So with our hearts, so yes, with those qualities of awakening, of freedom and love and so on, and with the example of the Buddha and all those countless men and women over the centuries, we commit ourselves to emulating the Buddha, to living a life based on the Dharma and relying on the Sangha. Particularly those who've seen how things really are to some extent, who can guide us in the right direction. And as Arya Jayar mentioned last week, this commitment to going for refuge makes you a Buddhist. But in the Buddhist tradition, going for refuge is often identified just with the kind of initial commitment to the journey. Yeah, saying that this is what you're going to do. Further stages of the voyage become associated with things like taking the bodhisattva vow or becoming a monk or a nun. But for Bhante Sangharakshita, going for refuge, and for me, going for refuge isn't just the commitment to sail for freedom. It's the driving force that keeps you sailing on. In sunshine and in storm, until you reach your final destination. Yeah. It's the motive power. It's the motive power for the whole journey. And that going for refuge isn't just about willpower. Although at times, some willpower can be necessary and really helpful. That driving force comes from a combination of factors. It comes from seeing our existential situation, seeing that we aren't safe where we are, seeing that however much from a lot of people's perspective, we're in a very good situation. We're just temporarily in a very good situation. It's not going to last. Yeah. So on that level, yes, that can sort of push us on. Yeah. Seeing that, we're in a very insecure situation. Secondly, and in a way even more, we're drawn on by coming into contact with that yearning in ourselves, that sort of longing in our heart for all the beautiful and wonderful qualities of awakening, all of which are potentially in us. And if we go into that feeling in our heart, we may find that there's one particular one at a certain phase in our practice, which, if we contact it, is the foremost one. That's what's really leading us on. We really, really, really want to understand how life is. Crazy, isn't it? Sort of, here we are, human beings, we've been living on this planet for however many years it is. We don't understand really very much about what it means to be a human being or what the purpose of life is or any of that. And we can find out. Or perhaps we just really, really, really want to be free. Yeah. We're tired of leading a limited, confined, constricted, anxious life, or whatever it is for us. Yeah, we just tap in to that deep longing and we let it motivate us. We let it carry us on the journey. And then we can be drawn on by the inspiration of seeing people like us who have made the journey, who've made the voyage. The Buddha, other great practitioners. I think there's reading the life stories, the biographies of Buddhist practitioners is a wonderful thing to do. It's a really good way of keeping our inspiration going. And one of the crucial aspects of Dharma practice is guarding our sources of inspiration. I was leading a retreat last week where I was talking about how Bhante used to say that chairs are centres. In a way, the one thing that they had to do was to be guarding the sources of inspiration in the centre. But it's not just the chair who has to do that. Yeah, we all need to do that. You know, very often we're sort of trying to practice to push ourselves along without much inspiration and motivation. And rather than going back and finding more and inspiring ourselves so that, yes, we want to meditate and we want to practice and we want to be generous and we want to get involved with the Sangha and we want to practice ethics and so on, we're sort of trying to push ourselves with an idea that it's a sort of good thing to do, but it comes just from the surface, so it doesn't really work. So a kind of central part of our practice has to be constantly working on our motivation and our inspiration, so that's what's driving us. There's a deeper level of ourselves in play. If we do that, it's so much easier. So much easier. So, yes, we can tune in to people who've really practiced, to their kindness, their compassion, their wisdom, their complete liberation from any kind of suffering. And we can be drawn on by a vision of how through practice we can become more and more like them. And we don't just think, oh, well, I could never become like Milarepa. That's not the point. The point is that every step that we take in that direction is a step where we're that much freer, that much happier, that much more able to contribute to the world, and every step we take is worth taking. So rather than sort of thinking, oh, I can't be exceptional, actually, those people usually weren't exceptional either, but they just kept going and kept going and kept going. It doesn't really matter what you start as. You don't have to be anything great to start with. You just have to really keep the Dharma in mind and keep working with it. And the Dharma does it, if you see what I mean. Yeah, so we can become something exceptional. But we expect too much of ourselves to start with, and not enough of ourselves after years of practice. So as we make this voyage, this journey, we'll go through different experiences. Various experiences will unfold. And I'll be talking more about some of these over the next 3 weeks. There'll be experiences of deeper understandings, eventually becoming real insights, direct seeings of how things are, seeings into the true nature of things. There will be more and more compassion opening up until eventually there's the arising of the bodhicitta, as it's called. And there'll also be a radical reorientation of the whole focus of our mind. This is known as the paravritti, the turning about, literally, in the Yogacara vision of Buddhism. So over the next 3 weeks, we'll really look into these three. The insight dimension, the altruistic dimension, compassion, and what we could call the We need another dimension, a depth dimension. Yeah. Exploring and working to affect deep levels of mind through our practice. And over the next few weeks, yeah, we'll probably do it less metaphorically than we have been this evening. I'll be aiming to make the rest of the series more immediately practical. Addressing issues that arise as we move in those three areas, as we move deeper into understanding, as we do our best to open our heart, and as we do our best to contact deeper levels of mind, deeper levels of awareness. But in talking about insight and stream entry, bodhicitta, the power of vritti, the turning about on a deep level of mind, we won't be leaving behind going for refuge. Rather, we'll be unfolding or unpacking aspects of that central commitment. Bhante talks about there being one central spirit, well, one spiritual experience, almost, which has these different aspects to it. So, the aspect of insight, the aspect of the arising of great compassion, the aspect of this turning about on a deep level of consciousness. Not that they all reveal themselves all at once. Not that if you have some kind of spiritual experience, necessarily they're all there. You could have an experience of insight, say, and it might not necessarily, at least for quite a long time, appear to have much to do with compassion, say. But over time, as we keep making the voyage of going for refuge, all these different kinds of experiences, all these aspects will open up. They will unfold. They'll all be part of the unfolding of our going for refuge. And going for refuge is the red thread, or the golden thread, that runs through them all. So let's go back. Let's go back to our wayfinder to get a sense of how that might be. So there they are, sitting at their place, their special place, at the stern of the boat, in sun and wind and rain. I think in the past they may usually have been men, but these traditions are being kept alive, these skills are being kept alive in the 21st century, and these days at least, you can have a woman wayfinder. So there they sit, in all weathers, staying aware and awake nearly all the time. You could say with ongoing mindfulness, just continuous awareness going through each moment of their life, hour after hour after hour. And they're deeply in touch with their experience, very directly in touch with nature, with the currents, with the wind, with the sun and the moon and the stars, all the conditions that they're under. And this kind of knowing of the conditions that they're under is a kind of mundane analogy and a mundane counterpart for the deep awareness and knowing of dependent arising. that comes with insight into reality. And these wayfinders aren't alone. The lives of everyone on board is in their hands. They depend on their skill and awareness. So there's a kind of mundane parallel with the compassion, with the open heart of the Bodhisattva, whose life is devoted to helping others find their freedom, find their happiness. And these wayfinders see things from a radically different perspective from everyone else. In their vision, the way they've been schooled to see things, the boat isn't moving. The boat stays where it is, apart from being pointed in a particular direction. The boat stays where it is, and if it's correctly oriented, eventually the destination island comes over the horizon and comes to meet the boat. And this completely reversed view of things is akin to the radical transformation of mind, mind's whole orientation that occurs with the turning about in the deepest seat of consciousness. But all these elements serve one purpose, one vision. And the motive force that keeps the wayfinder awake, sustained, all through the journey, is that they hold in their mind a vision of the island that they wish to reach. All their actions serve the purpose of that island appearing over the horizon and coming closer and closer until the journey is done. Similarly, once we have a vision of an island of safety, an island of freedom, with going for refuge, we work step by step, day by day, gradually steering every aspect of our lives in that direction, never giving up, until we come safely home to true freedom from suffering, safely home to true understanding of how things are, safely home to great love and compassion. And then our journey's done. Our going for refuge to the three jewels will be completed. Then we shall have become the refuge.
Out into the ocean, much further as the weeks go by.